I will turn 85 years young this Friday. 85. Some might call this particular era in my life golden, while others gussy it up as living in the golden years. Why ores? Is it some ode to the minerals, the dust from which we are all created? Silver and gold, so often singled out as part of the shimmer of the holidays. Should I be shimmering? Like some tree in the corner of a house, bejeweled in garish lights and ghastly globs of glitter, drawing attention to myself in hopes no one forgets to water me, lest I shrivel? I do not shrivel. Never have. Shriveling. Never. Shriveling is shrinking, and while I may not be as statuesque as I once or ever was, shrinking away from anything is not my bag. Bag. Another foul word. Old bag. Last summer, I caught the Elliott boys down the way pitching rocks at my sweet fat orange barn cat Lucy. Morons! Heathens! I called out as they tore out down the street. As they shrank in the distance, I bellowed, I'll take a willow switch to your behinds if I catch you numbskulls anywhere near my property again. One of them screeched,
Old bag!
As they disappeared from sight. A pack of wild hyenas. Saddling each boy with sandbags and watching as they sink in a slimy pond would be too merciful for the lot. Shriveling. Ah! Helen Wolcott doesn't shrivel from anything. Not at 85 and not since I was 14. I face my fears. I face life's challenges head on. Now, I didn't learn this from my pa, nor from my Aunt Ada, who helped raise me after Ma passed. I learned to be strong from my companion, my confidant, my first love, Peggy. Now, to meet her, you would not have guessed Peggy had the heart of a lion. I met Peggy in the back row of our one-room schoolhouse in Creighton, Missouri, and I gotta tell you, she made quite an impression. Peggy often wore her long, dark, unruly hair in a ponytail tied with a white ribbon. Skinny as a rail she was. Hell, you could have turned her sideways and she'd win at hide-and-seek. Her skin so pale, almost translucent it was, with blue veins dangerously close to the surface. Her face a constellation of dark red freckles. Peggy wore the same simple sky blue cotton dress no matter what time of the year. Dependent on the season, she covered it with an old stained men's yellow rain slicker, draped it in a smelly wool plaid coat with the buttons hanging by frayed threads, or threw on a patchwork shawl just like the blanket Aunt Ada threw over the end of my bed in the fall. But always the same blue cotton dress. At 14 years old, I was larger than Peggy. A bit of a chunk, truth be told. The metamorphosis which transformed me into the lithe figure before you now had yet to occur. Working on Pa's dairy farm, I always had my fill of fresh cow milk, just-made cheese, and rich homemade ice cream, which took hours to hand-crank. I worshipped Aunt Ada's cooking, her pies, her biscuits, her fresh hog sausage, and, well, you get the picture. I ate my fill. However, Peggy, from what I witnessed when we ate our lunch in the small school cafeteria or outside on the steps of the playground, ate the same deviled ham spread sandwich on Wonder Bread with a sweet pickle every day. It was likely our stark physical contrast that led to a burgeoning and incessant ridicule heaped upon us by the mean older boys and prissy, well-coiffed uptown girls in class. You should see some of those cows now. The surviving ones, anyway. The taunts still echo in my mind. Rub a tub or hammy Helen to me. Toothpick or shadow to her, to name a few idiotic monikers. Out of necessity and an inherent need to survive adolescence, we became thick as thieves. warding off the pimple-faced morons trying to stick bubblegum into our hair and garden snakes into our desk drawers became routine. We took turns scratching out many a vile adjective inked on our desktops, and yanked each other back on countless occasions from being tripped on the way to the chalkboard. I remember sitting there in the stifling schoolroom, counting down the hours on the round chrome wall clock by the door, sighing with relief when it struck 3 and Miss Evans played her metal triangle, signaling the time to put our books away and go home. Peggy, however, never sighed. As young girls do, Peggy and I shared everything. Sweet secrets about what we dreamed we would become. Me, a scientist, capable of creating a medicine that would cure women of the cancer that had eaten up Ma's belly before I was 11. Peggy, the next Amelia Earhart, traveling the globe, sharing stories to the world about her experiences on faraway islands and mysterious cultures that folks in the middle of Kansas never dreamed existed. Peggy confided her mother had skipped town and that she really couldn't even remember her face. Perhaps wanderlust was in Peggy's DNA. Peggy lived in the back of her father's mechanic shop in the worst part of our town, on the corner of 6th and Pruitt, next door to a gin joint, Buster's Honky Tonk. Once, and only once, she invited me to her room after school to show me her secret treasure box. As we crossed the alleyway to enter the shop, I glanced sideways in time to see a blind, drunk man relieving himself behind a dumpster. I recall the stench of old motor oil and burnt rubber assaulting my nose as we slid quietly under the partially raised garage door. I followed her lead, ducking down, hidden behind the skeletons of old Model Ts and huge Buick fins as we slid along a grimy wall, down a dark and narrow hall, and behind a dirty orange curtain into her tiny room. Peggy held a panel back as I pushed past her. I remember thinking her whole room would fit in our pantry at home. It had a floor that wasn't exactly dirt, but whatever the next best thing was, that was it. She had 2 pretty pink blankets hung from the walls at the head and foot of her bed in kind of a cove. Her bed cover was a thin cotton throw that looked suspiciously similar to the dress she always wore. A small pine dresser with a tackle box painted in different colors on top of it, and a really sweet pink ballerina lamp next to it. A chair in the corner was home to a large, dirty pink stuffed lamb. She tossed the lamb onto her bed, revealing an open metal violin back and torn tan leather seat with slices of tape on the corner. With a dramatic flair, she motioned for me to sit down. I studied the walls while Peggy hummed her favorite Doris Day tune, Sentimental Journey, and rattled through what she called her rainbow-colored mystery box. There were dozens of tattered pictures of airplanes on her walls, torn from magazines or newspapers. Most of them were military, but there were a few of the newer sleek 2-propeller planes that looked like the type Betty Grable and Veronica Lake would ride around the country in, selling war bonds. My eyes wandered back to the back of Peggy's pale, bare legs. I imagined silk stockings with seams covering them, like Betty and Veronica wore during their tours, the soldiers ogling them and cheering. I became so flush and clammy I didn't even notice Peggy had turned back around and was smiling at me. Brushing away blonde strands of hair stuck to the sweat on my forehead, I tried my best to distract from the moment, laughing.
"It took you long enough. What have you got there?"
In Peggy's hand was an old greenish-gray aviator's hat, exactly the kind Amelia Earhart had worn. She put it on for me, shoving her wild hair under it as best she could. Then she spun around, rattled in the box for a moment, emerging with what looked like an almost new lady's lipstick with a shiny gold screw cap. Grinning ear to ear, she exclaimed,
"It's called Lover's Red."
Now I was 14, and good Nazarene girls didn't wear lipstick in 1945. If Pa or Aunt Ada caught a whisper of it, there would have been Hades to pay, I can tell you that. But I could not resist her smile. And really, I think that was the first time I had even seen her smile. Her green eyes sparkled behind her long, dark eyelashes. Her deep dimples almost swallowed the whole constellation of freckles. And her pale pink lips gave way to brilliant white, if a bit crooked and cockeyed, teeth. I was mesmerized.
"Come on, Helen. Go ahead. Try some on."
I couldn't resist. I took the lipstick from her, and she shoved a small broken compact mirror in front of me. I leaned in and tried to put the waxy stuff on, but it wasn't exactly smooth, and I couldn't make a straight line. Peggy was amused.
"Let me show you how, silly."
She pressed her left cheek against my right, and I watched in awe as she perfectly lined her lips. Next, she slid her tongue along her thinly arched top lip, then full plumper bottom one. Once moistened, she carefully filled them, the red wax transforming before my eyes into a crimson satin.
"Wow," I whispered, long enough for her to hear me. "I wish I could have those lips."
The next moment still astonishes me to this day. It also forever changed my life. She lowered the small mirror in her right hand and turned her face until the tips of our noses were touching.
"You can have these lips, Helen."
She kissed me, softly, delicately. It felt like a butterfly had landed on my lips. I kissed her back, mirroring her tenderness. She whispered,
"Don't press any harder next time. You'll smear me."
I giggled. Her beautiful eyes closed, and she leaned into me, her arms slipping around my shoulders, her satin lips pressing mine. It was perfect. A perfect moment there in her grungy little room. Perfect until...
"Peg, you home from school, Peg? Answer me, girl."
Heavy footsteps drew near. Peggy's eyes opened wide in terror. She grabbed a loose corner of one of the pink wall blankets and in a desperate whisper said,
"Wipe it off!"
Desperately, I rubbed the cloth across my lips so hard they could have come off. The orange curtain burst open, and in stepped a very tall, thin man, around 40, I think. A musty aroma whooshed in behind him, thin as a scarecrow. Greasy gray pinstriped coveralls hiked up over the tops of old, worn, black-buckled boots. Harold crudely stitched on a patch in red thread over his left chest. Pasted on his narrow skull was a thin mat of black hair, combed straight back with what appeared to be motor oil. His voice was harsh.
"Well, well, what do we have here?"
Harold said, his voice lisping through the four or five tar-brown teeth he still had left. I felt sick.
"Father?"
Peggy began in a meek voice, her eyes lowered to the floor, her aviator cap still in place.
"This is my friend Helen from school."
I nodded, too afraid to speak.
"Friend, I told you never to bring anyone to the shop, didn't I? Never to bring anyone back here, girl, didn't I? Now you have a lesson to learn that they don't teach at school."
Oh, how his voice was so flat and terrifying. I stood up from the chair, ready to rush out of the room, to take my chances in the alley behind Buster's if I had to. It would be safer than in that room. But Harold stepped back, blocking my escape. Doom crowded the damp air. He turned to Peggy.
"What the hell you got on, girl?"
He turned his gaze, his flat, colorless eyes sizing us up. But for what?
It's lipstick.
Peggy sidestepped closer to me. Her right shoulder touched my left. I sensed she was trying to muster a defiant tone, trying to defend me. But the terror in her voice was evident by the tremble in it.
Smudged on both of you. Well, now, isn't this pretty? So pretty. Why don't I take a stab at smudging it, too?
His question was at once vile and threatening. I could smell his wretched breath dripping with cheap whiskey. I clutched Peggy's right hand. I wanted to run as far away as possible. Run to Timbuktu. Harold smiled and placed his dirty left thumb to his mouth. He spat and pressed it hard against Peggy's mouth, smearing the lipstick across one cheek, then the other, drawing a garish clown's smile. He whipped off her aviator cap, spilling her hair in all directions. His hands began to travel down her neck, down to the front of her dress. White-hot tears streamed from my eyes. I took a step back and felt her bed against my calves. In a sinister dance, he stepped forward.
We were just playing movie star.
I cried, my salty tears burning my raw lips.
Yes, Father, I was pretending to be Myrna Loy, and Helen was Joan Crawford.
Before Peggy could finish her sentence, Harold balled up his right fist and struck her in the stomach, knocking her back on the bed. She gasped for air.
Stop, I screamed. Stop now, Harold. Lay a hand on Peggy again, and I'll call the whole damned army.
I don't know where my words came from. I don't know if I had ever even raised my voice to the level I was using. I'd never even used the word damn before. Heck, I wasn't even sure if it was my voice. I would have been grounded into the great beyond if Pa heard me. Then his filthy hand cupped my chin. With all my might, I shoved him right in his groin with both my fists. He lost his footing and fell backward, landing hard on the floor, cursing and spitting in agony. I made my move. Yanking Peggy's arm, I dragged her off the bed. She stumbled and kicked Harold again, by happy accident, in the same place I had hit him. He groaned in pain. We shoved through the curtains back down the narrow hall, clambering through the garage full of old car parts and tools, gathering grease and tears in our clothes in the process, and finally clearing the half-raised door. We ran, fast as the wind would take us, never looking back. We ran out of that filth, out into the waning afternoon sun, and out into our freedom. I bet we kicked up quite a dust cloud behind us as we whizzed through town, dodging the pits and holes in the dirt and gravel streets on the way back to my house. I told my Pa everything. Everything, of course, but the kissing part. Pa and Aunt Ada called the sheriff, and not long after that, Peggy went to live in a foster home just down the street from us for the rest of that year and most of the next. Then Harold was killed. Stumbled out of Buster's and was hit by a passing truck New Year's Eve, 1946. After that, Peggy went to live in Sweetwater Springs with her aunt, an agonizing hour away, and to another school. We stayed in touch for a few years, writing perfumed letters to each other and calling each other person to person, meaningless to the young folks today. But the letters dwindled and the calls grew more sporadic as life took us in different directions. Me to a nursing career, and Peggy, bless her soul, to the Air Force, where she flew planes for the Red Cross until a crash in Korea in 1958 ended her story. It's not an all sad story, really. Peggy and I learned a lot about tenderness, about standing up for yourself, about what makes a real family. And quite a bit about love. Oh, and we both learned how to follow our dreams, and I learned not to shrink.